The Guardian.
This week on Film Weekly, with me, Jason Solomons. Fact and fiction blur on the internet as I meet Neve Shulman, whose documentary Catfish is so plausible, it's implausible. I'll be asking Neve if this zeitgeisty social networking thriller is the story of our time. Young Turks abound on the show this week as I meet the founder of Punk Films, writer-director Richard Bracewell, who's gathered a fine British cast for his eerie thriller, Cuckoo. Zan Brooks and I will be looking at the week's big releases, including Burlesque, Loose Cannons, and Tron Legacy. It's digital, it's ethereal, it's neon, it's Film Weekly. The key skill in modern documentary filmmaking is spotting the real story when it emerges from a mass of factual, everyday detail. Just like when two friends from Manhattan, Ariel Schulman and Henry Joost, began to observe, then film, the unfolding flirtation of Ariel's brother Neve and the seemingly perfect girl from Michigan, Megan. But as Neve's relationship deepened, something just didn't seem right and took three New York boys out of their urban comfort zone.
This is it. This is it. Just pull up.
You want to drive into the driveway?
Yeah. Are you crazy?
What do you mean?
Drive into the driveway.
What do you mean?
Don't drive. Back into it.
Why not?
Because then we can't see what's in front of us.
I'm a little scared.
This place gives me the creeps.
Let's go.
To tell me more, but not too much more, about Catfish, I met up with Neve here in London earlier in the week, and I began by asking him, at what point did he realise his private online exchanges might make a compelling cinematic narrative?
Unlike most films, there was no story, script, shape, direction, or even really intention in this film until it was already finished being shot, and then we came back from the trip. And, you know, I had only shared maybe 5% of the correspondence that I had been having with my brother and with Henry. So they were so shocked when I gave them access to my email and showed them the category I had created in my Gmail called, you know, Michigan, and the volume of emails. And so they went through, printed them, and read through them and said, you know, Neve, this is unbelievable. There's a real love story here that we didn't know about. And then I showed them the text messages and I showed them, you know, the voicemails. And it was, the story developed after the fact. Mm-hmm. And it was really the job to go back and rediscover clips from hard drives that had been ignored or right. forgotten about.
Lucky I hadn't deleted them. My trash kind of empties itself on my phone.
Yeah. So. Well, in fact, my phone didn't delete some voicemails at one point that I was really upset about. But it was sort of an investigation, both in the process of discovering the reality and then in the process of turning that into a film, because there was no concept of making it in the first place. Mm-hmm. So the filmmaking process in the editing room was really one of discovery as well.
Yeah, which is how fiction films are made as well, and documentaries these days. And we'll get on to what genre you're calling your film, because I don't think I've quite seen anything like it before, and I don't know where to put it, which is great, because that's a new thing. Hey, you invented something. But the core of this is this romance you mentioned that happens on kind of voicemail, text messages, a woman you never met before, only a picture that you've seen. How kind of close to you were you? How much did you fancy this girl?
You know, it's interesting. I've been lucky in having a number of wonderful women in my life that I've dated and been in relationships with. And of course, those relationships have always started in person. One was at college, then after college at a drawing class, and then most recently a dancer whom I met just, you know, out with some friends. Mm-hmm. And immediately, of course.
So you're saying you're not a serial kind of internet right, exactly. kind of dater. You're not a kind of Lonely Hearts column kind of guy. You're a good-looking boy. You don't need that sort of thing.
Well, thanks. So I'm used to meeting someone and having a physical attraction, usually primarily, and then finding out if, in fact, there is an emotional connection. In this case, unlike anything I had experienced, it started off as a friendship and then became emotional, but without the intrusion of a physical environment.
But so that, that must have been weird for you then.
It was weird, but at the same time, I think it allows, and I think, and I know a lot of people have had a similar experience in that there's a certain level of trust and comfortability because you're not vulnerable. And you're not being judged on how you look or feel or you know, how you dress. You don't have to worry about those awkward moments or at dinner or going out and meeting friends that you don't know yet. It's easier to open up and, I think, make yourself available.
You can project the persona that you want to.
Right, and being able to edit yourself, even just, you know, in G-chatting. Mm. Because if someone asks you a question, you might be a little uncomfortable answering. They're not going to see your face. Mm. They won't see you uncomfortable. And then you have those 3, 5, 10 seconds to think about how you want to respond. And it gives you a chance to, you know, edit yourself. And I think that's a big part of why people are really moving towards online dating, because it gives you the opportunity to create the perfect version that you'd like to be.
Or to lie. You saw a picture of her. Well, this is where we get into it. I mean, you saw a picture of her, and I have to say she was a very attractive young lady as well, and her voice sounded very attractive. She said the right things. So, but I mean, anyone at any level will kind of go, yeah, does he, I wonder if he really looks like that in real life.
Right. Definitely. You know, for the 8 months that I was corresponding with this family, there were moments of where I thought, you know, geez, this little girl, she's only supposed to be 8 years old. Her artwork's pretty good. And then, of course, I would see a photo montage of her, of this little girl standing in front of a canvas as it developed into a painting. So I would think, like, you know, that I can't imagine someone faking that. Mm. It's obviously her. It's her artwork. And the whole family was artistic and musical. And they would talk about how they would help Abby with her paintings. And then Megan would send me music, and some of it was pretty good, and I would think, like, wow, that's pretty good. But, you know, her brother had a band, and there was always a really good explanation.
Sure.
And there was also just such a huge volume of correspondence that was so arbitrary and every day.
And she was hot.
And the bottom line was that Megan was a virgin. She's 19. She rides horses. She plays the guitar. And she's super hot. And who doesn't want that girl sort of drooling over you and sending you pictures and messages all the time telling you how great she thinks you are? I mean, it's sort of every guy's fantasy.
Mm-hmm. So that was, because people have said, well, you know, there's a kind of hoax element going on here. And we'll get into that maybe a bit later, because that's a kind of element that happens a lot in documentaries. But you were genuinely, you thought, oh, this girl, you know, I'd be a fool not to have a look, because, I mean, you know, I was with you. I was like, she's attractive and it's going well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't want anyone.
Were you single?
Yeah, I was not involved. I was dating in New York, but I'd have to say I think honestly I was really looking for a different type of relationship, a different type of woman, a departure from the New York City girls that I had known.
Yeah, boy, you got that name. Careful what you wish for, they often say. And I think your film kind of proves that. But with not wanting to give anything away, I think it's a film that is constantly surprising. And I don't think we are giving anything away even by mentioning this element of it, because it's a film that probes the very nature of social interaction now. And obviously there's a big film out called The Social Network, which, as you know, I'm sure you've seen, is full of nice Jewish boys typing at the keyboard and making lots of money out of it. For me, it's, you know, it's a very witty and kind of very well-turned film, but it didn't really explain to me what the world is like now in the world of Facebook and social interaction. Your film seems to exist only through those things. In fact, your film doesn't even have beautiful shot making. No aspersions on your camera work. But much of it is like watching the computer screen, which is what we do half the day.
Yeah, our priority, our real sort of mission statement with the film was that we wanted, in the end, to recreate our experience as closely to how it was for us. And so we didn't light anything. We never worried about sound equipment. We just recorded a story, and the story always came first. And it helps that my brother and Henry are filmmakers, so they have a general understanding of getting a shot or rolling, even though you think maybe you should cut, just keep rolling. And we did have our equipment with us, but it was really just an unbelievably lucky, strange circumstance that led us on this journey with our film equipment to this story. And the bottom line is that, you know, Facebook, the social network, is sort of the origin of social networking, and our movie is kind of like a status update. And it really shows how the internet is an amazing tool, but it's a powerful and potentially dangerous one, and it can easily sort of snowball and kind of you can lose control of it.
The final thing I want to know is what sort of film is it? When the shortlist for the Academy's Oscar nominees came out, I was really thinking Catfish was going to be on there. And now I'm thinking maybe they don't even know it's a documentary.
You know, it's interesting. In a time when the line between fiction and nonfiction is becoming more and more blurred, especially in film and television, I find it so frustrating that our film has been lumped into a category of sort of question mark, is it a documentary, is it not? Because I happen to know that it's completely real, and that in many ways our film is a definition of documentary. I mean, it's a real-life film, handheld, as it happened, shown in chronological order. There's no voiceover, which is scripted. There's no interviews, which are set up. It's just real life. And in some ways, it's like a pure documentary. Yeah. And I think that's what's sort of off-putting people, because it doesn't look and feel like the sort of traditional information, educational, politically charged documentary that we're used to.
But the documents you have Gmail, you have voicemails, right. You have Facebook traces, you have video evidence, you have, it's like a police collage. You are piecing together reality.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. It is a collage of document, both video, text, graphic. And so in its purest form, you could call it just a document of an event. And in fact, we're being sued right now by one of the musicians' label whose song we used under the fair use policy because it's a documentary and we don't need to clear or pay for licensing because the music is in the story and the story existed and it's part of the story. And they're arguing that whether or not it's real or not, to be a documentary, it has to either be educational or socially relevant. And they don't feel like our film is.
Right, so this is going to court?
Well, hopefully not.
But someone needs to define. This would be great because now we'll have the documentary defined.
It's really interesting that this movie is sort of maybe going to become the case study on how to define, in the film world, a documentary. And I think it's important and it needs to be defined and that new genres need to be coined or invented for films that are some reality and some fiction, because there are a lot of those. And so there should just be a genre for those. That way you don't piss anybody off when you release a film under the sort of very broad documentary genre and have them find out later that, oh, well, some of it's not real life.
Which song is it, may I ask?
I don't know.
It's not important. It's like, it could be. It could be very important. No, there's only a few songs in there. I mean, I didn't know them myself. Square, but I didn't know any of the songs. But so one of those. Even in the film, it's about passing because she passes it off as her own. I assume it's one of those songs. So it's about who lays claim to that song in the first place.
Yeah, right. I mean, and what's interesting too is that, in my opinion, the movie, the song being in the film, has only helped the career and the exposure of that music anyway. So
I never heard of them.
Well, right. Yeah. So it's just we're fascinated by the conversation, both having to do with social media and social networking, and now, surprisingly, in how to determine the authenticity of a documentary.
Well, brilliant. Well, I wish you luck redefining the bounds of a genre that's existed as long as film has. So for that, Catfish, congratulations. Niamh, thank you so much for coming on Film Weekly, and best of luck with the film, wherever it goes, because to me it's one of the kind of most interesting things. Oh, I won't say documentary in case would you want it to be a documentary? What did you want it? Would you like it?
You want it to be a documentary?
It's a documentary.
By me, it's a documentary too. Mazel tov. The Extraordinary Catfish is on UK-wide release from Friday the 17th of December. And from Catfish to Big Fish, Zan Brooks, the critic, joins me in the podcast studio now. We just heard from Niamh Shulman there about Catfish. Where are you on Catfish?
Well, I loved it. I was utterly gripped by it. But I think it's another one of those slippery documentaries, isn't it?
Is it a hoax?
Well, I don't think it's a hoax.
I'm just asking you like I asked Casey Affleck.
Yeah, that was a good one. You kind of almost got a confession out of him that he then made.
That he lied.
Yeah, he lied straight to your face, didn't he? Weirdly, it's one of the most gripping films I've seen this year.
I think it's the film of the year. Not in the way it's the best film of the year, but it's sort of the film that I've seen this year that is about now the most.
It is, but I still had slight problems with it. It struck me as a film about, without giving too much away, somebody out in the Midwest who sets out to fool these New York hipsters for whatever reason, and they end up kind of fooling her.
Yeah, but that kind of... Do they? In the end, who comes out on top? It's
a very troubling, dark, disturbing film.
I found it extremely unsettling.
And it is one that you know, I saw it last week, and it's kind of stayed with me.
Yeah, since. I mean, I saw it longer ago than that, and I think of it all the time now, every time I see that Facebook logo, much more than The Social Network, which I think is a very safe kind of interpolation of what's going on.
This lifts up the rock, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Catfish. Ooh, we like here on Film Weekly. Good. Perhaps go see or go download. Zan, we're going to talk also about Burlesque this week. We're going to talk about Tron this week. Then we'll talk about the reissues around. I'll tell you about Loose Cannons. But perhaps we can start with Tron, the legacy in which Jeff Bridges meets his younger self.
Sam. Long time. You have no idea. You're here. You're here. I'm here. You're big.
You're
old.
So what do I mean, Jeff Bridges meets his younger self? What am I talking about?
Well, Jeff Bridges, of course, memorably, among many of the memorable roles that memorable Jeff Bridges has given us in his time, was in the original Tron back in 1982, which I remember my godfather kind of unveiling with his great flourish of this is the future of cinema, and sitting watching it on home video with my kind of eyes bleeding.
This is the future of cinema. He clunked in the old VHS.
Yeah, the old Betamax.
Yeah, bang.
but, you know, that was the times. And, you know, all we had was gruel and, bit of bread, bit of bread and butter.
Exactly.
And Tron. And that's how we passed the days.
It did look pretty cool back then, didn't it?
It did look pretty cool, but it was painful to watch, I remember, in that it was the future then. And this very much pays homage to that future.
Yeah.
In the design of it is very 80s, isn't it?
Yes, in a way. I mean, they created a design classic, I think, in 1982 without sort of knowing it. And it's become a design classic, that whole electro.
Well,
didn't
I think
really
they kind of did know it, but the world didn't know it at that
point.
Yeah,
well, I wasn't kind of aware of Mies van der Rohe and Eames chairs at the time.
No.
But I am now.
You not like them now, don't you?
I would love an Eames chair. There's a white Eames chair in Ottoman
don't
in this.
Don't spoil my Christmas
please.
Gift to you.
Oh.
So this it kind of now looks very retro.
Yeah.
It looks like a sort of 1980s wine bar a bit, doesn't it? This vast digital universe that the Jeff Bridges character, Kevin Flynn, has designed and then vanished into, which is now ruled by his sort of shadowy avatar.
It's a sort of Dorian Gray thing going on as well, because the real Kevin Flynn is there and he's old. And he lives in the kind of
boutique
hotel with the Barcelona chairs, etc. And then there's the avatar who's got that kind of dead behind the eyes look that... You know, they've made the young Jeff Bridges' face, but it's not the young Jeff Bridges from that film.
No.
Is it? It's a kind of composite.
It's a weird composite, isn't it? And then you've got the son, Sam, played by Garrett Hedlund, who's an actor I don't really know.
I've never heard of him.
Who heads off to find his dad.
He kind of enters the portal. It's hidden behind an arcade game.
Yep.
So any advice for people at home who've got this big arcade game, don't open the back. Well, you can. It's like an Alice in Wonderland thing, isn't it? Down he goes and he's into the virtual world.
Mm.
I do you know what? I was thinking it was all silly and preposterous and all that, and I don't really care for Garrett Helgeland or whatever his name is. But I suddenly, when they went to that world, I was like, actually, this looks really good, and they play that disc-throwing game, and he has to kind of go through the kind of Olympiad of electronic games. I was thinking, this looks really cool.
I found it a little bit relentless, a little bit remorseless.
Well, it's just another set. You could take one of those set pieces where they have to do a video game, another level, let's call it, out of it, and that would shorten it by sort of a good 15 minutes, and it might clip along a bit.
I think so.
I was kind of all into the look of it. I mean, I really wasn't listening to anything anyone was saying because it was all sort of pretentious. But I did love the design, and I loved the music.
The music's great. Yeah. This I liked it more than I thought I would, but it's still a little bit leaden. I probably liked it more than I like my 13-year-old self liked the original Tron.
It'd be great if you could go down a portal and watch
and find myself dead behind the eyes.
Yeah,
I'd be.
You would be, wouldn't you? And now you look you look a lot like the new Jeff Bridges, all craggy, old, true gritted, crazy
hearted. Winged chariot.
That's Tron, the legacy. Talking of old people being resurrected from the dead, here's Cher and Christina Aguilera in Burlesque.
Let me help you. First of all, you got to wet it if you're going to get a clean line.
What's right?
When you are putting on your makeup, it's like you're an artist. But instead of painting on a canvas, you're painting your face. Didn't you ever watch your mom put on her makeup?
My mom died when I was 7, and it's my first lesson.
Cher had retired, would you know it, and they forced her back into a bustier to be the sort of madame of
she
Burlesque.
She thought she was out, and they pulled her back in.
They pulled her back in. I didn't see Burlesque, much to my chagrin, because I have a feeling this would really tickle my little guilty pleasure button.
Well, if you like Showgirls, you'll love Burlesque.
Showgirls the movie or Showgirls in general?
Just in general. Yeah. Yeah, you're an aficionado.
I certainly am.
This is... you know, this is A Star Is Born, isn't it? Although I guess it's A Star Is Still Born, considering the star is Christina Aguilera.
Yeah, she's a bit of a star already.
Who plays Ali, who's a sort of Midwestern ingenue who waits tables but really dreams of being a singer and a dancer.
Yeah, I have a problem with Christina Aguilera as an ingenue. She knows to know a lot to me.
She does, doesn't she?
How does she get on?
She gets on all right, surprisingly. Yeah, you wouldn't have thought it, would you?
No.
In a film such as this. She ends up on Sunset Boulevard, where dreams are made, and specifically at the Burlesque Club, which is run by Cher and her gay best friend, played by Stanley Tucci.
Oh, he's a very reliable gay best friend.
He's very reliable, and he's kind of good in this. And
he's
always good, and he raises it a level. It's pretty bad, this.
Is it?
As you'd expect.
Is there not a lot of shouting and busts?
There's shouting busks. There's sort of songs that sound like they're kind of sung on a tannoy.
If you like, because there's no musical. There's no musicals this year at the Christmas theatre.
No,
the
last
Christmas
year
cinema.
We had 9, and what a treat that
yeah,
was.
Yeah, is this sort of...
This is this year's 9.
This is turning it up.
Put that on the poster.
That's Burlesque. Zan, there are some good films around. I've seen Loose Cannons.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sort of staying on a kind of quite sort of gay tip here.
Yeah.
Loose Cannons, it's by Ferzan Özpetek, the sort of Turkish-Italian filmmaker who did the Ignorant Fairies. He makes films about gay characters trying to assimilate into vibrant Italian life.
Right.
And this is no exception. It's based in the beautiful southern town of Lecce, where I spent a very nice summer holiday a couple of years ago. So it was nice to be reminded of that.
No, non lo sai, appena sono pronte te le faccio vedere.
Ricordati sempre quello che diceva Nicola. La qualità è la prima cosa, ma poi la pasta deve diventare bella.
An Apulian pasta family whose fortune is kind of under threat from two sons coming out at the same time, causing heart attacks at dinner. It's lots of dinner parties, lots of cliches, lots of kind of sexy characters, lots of cliches in that kind of Italian way, lots of kind of gay men coming down from Rome and dancing in the Asia Adriatic Sea. It's kind of lightly comic and sort of refreshing, like a summer holiday, and I kind of enjoyed it.
Is it a bit cloying? Sounds a bit cloying.
It's not as cloying as all of as that. It is probably a bit cloying, but in a way that sort of a good arrabbiata sauce should cloy to a rigatoni.
Well, I was going to say it's like a gelato. Is it like a gelato?
There's a scene where gelato is involved, as there is in is in somewhere the Sofia Coppola film.
Yes, there is. Yeah,
it is a bit like genre. That, but it's a passeggiato gelato. It's kind of the necessary kind of thing that they have in Lecce at night. There's a bit in this film in Lecce where they go and have a cup of tea, a cup of champagne, a coppa, in a bar, in a colonnade, where I also myself drank a
It's like your life, isn't it?
It is my life.
Somewhere.
Yeah, somewhere and this. I'm somewhere in between. That's Loose Cannons, which I think is quite fun. And especially when it's cold outside.
Voilà des sardines avec une belle tartine.
C'est pas trop tôt. Ça vous plaît?
But there are two reissues which we must just touch on for our audience. We've got two classics, Jean Renoir and Ernst Lubitsch. Jean Renoir's film, Boudou Saved from Drowning, has been luminously remastered with a very controversial scene reinstated in which Michel Simon spits on a book of Balzac. Which apparently was very controversial back in the day. And the prefecture of police asked him to remove it because it could cause a riot in the streets.
Only in France would they riot at that.
Exactly.
Show that in England, people are like, who?
Absolutely. Exactly. It just looks great because when I saw this film, I think in Paris in the 80s, and it was really scratchy. You couldn't really kind of understand the sound had gone. So they've really worked on that, and it now looks just brilliant. And I love Jean Renoir. I think he is my
he's great. And
favorite director.
Possibly is my favorite. This and Rules of the Game, I think, are the two ones that I kind of come back to.
Yeah, I mean, they both don't age. I mean, I love the golden, what's it called? Carros d'Or, Golden Chariot. That I love, and French Cancan as well, and The River.
The River.
We could talk Jean Renoir for ages. Boudou Saved from Drowning, about the tramp who's saved from the banks of the Seine by a bookseller and then gets to live with him. A bourgeois satire, if ever there was one, was remade in Hollywood as
Down and Out in Beverly Hills.
Richard Dreyfuss and Bette Midler. Mm-hmm. Our next reissue is Shop Around the Corner,
which was also remade
as.
You've Got Mail.
Very good.
Very
Sam
badly.
Brooks.
Very badly remade.
And it also sort of, I mean, Down and Out Beverly Hills is quite an obvious remake because Nick Nolte plays the tramp. You've Got Mail is sort of very, very loose Shop Around the Corner remake.
Yes, it was. There was no internet back in the day.
There wasn't.
But there was Jimmy Stewart and Margaret Sullivan as the sort of the squabbling colleagues who unknown to them, are in love through their letters.
Classic rom-com stuff.
Yes,
it is. Ernst Lubitsch, but also very moving and very set on Christmas Eve in Matuszek's kind of leather gift shop. It was just delightful. I loved it.
And it's that weird thing of the sort of gingerbread Jewish Eastern European play being kind of Hollywoodized. So it has all that kind of snap, crackle and spick and spanness of Hollywood, but that sort of warmth and that heart of that tradition.
It's amazing because it's set in Budapest and it's clearly the work of a Jewish filmmaker in it, but it's amazing. There's nothing Jewish about it at all. It's set on Christmas Eve, Jimmy Stewart, Margaret Sullivan, two less Jewish characters you couldn't have.
Yeah.
It's sort of amazing because it's clearly a little Jewish, you know, shtetl folktale
type thing
from Budapest.
Yeah.
And they've kind of de-Jewed it.
And Margaret Sullivan is great in these roles. There's this film that I love that nobody else seems to have heard of called The Good Fairy, scripted by Preston Sturges, but I think from an old Eastern European play originally. And she stars in that, and it's a sort of similar kind of ditzy character, and she's just wonderful in that.
Yeah,
too.
She's great in this. There's a great bit where she reaches, which is the You've Got Mail thing, where there's a Meg Ryan bit where she kind of can't get her AOL to work. This one, she can't, because it's a sort of post box that she goes to get her letters, and there's just a shot of her hand. I mean, I'm always against shots from inside microwaves and tumble dryers, because as Scorsese always says, who's inside there? Why are you in there? Yeah. This one is from the other side of the post restante, which of course there is another side because that's where the guy puts the mail in, and she's got her hand like looking for the mail that's not there. Oh, my voice is breaking as I record it.
She's great, Margaret Sullivan.
Yeah. And Jimmy Stewart, I think, is my favourite actor.
Is he?
Yeah, whenever I see him, I just go, oh, that's how you do film acting.
Yeah, he's certainly top 10 for me.
Yeah, exactly. Well, talking of top 10s, and we shall reconvene next week and discuss our top 10 of the year. We're asking our listeners to email in with their top 3s of the year for a fantastic competition we've got lined up. I'm not going to tell you what that is just yet.
There's some good choices on there. I've had a look on the Facebook
page.
They see
they're doing it, the Facebook. Yep. Look at you. You're like catfish itself, swimming in the internet world.
Yeah, well, you know, when I was Facebooking Megan, I took time out to just look at some top 3s.
Yeah, exactly. No pictures required, incidentally, though it doesn't disqualify you. So your top 3s, if they chime with Anne and mine, all the more interesting. But if not, it doesn't matter. Send us your top 3s. We're looking to see what the Film Weekly listener has enjoyed in the year 2010. And I'm talking from January the 1st, 2010, all the way up to December the 31st, the night on which my second child is due to arrive in this world.
Wow, that's going to be quite a show, isn't it?
Exactly. That might be my top film of the year, but I'm not going to film it. Zan, lovely to see you. Happy Christmas to you. We'll reconvene next week.
Look forward to it.
filmmaking brothers are a bit of a theme in this week's show. In 2004, Richard and Tony Bracewell launched their independent production company, Punk Films, and a year later released their first film, The Gigolos, set in the dark corners of Mayfair at night, and it garnered international acclaim, if not huge audiences. Richard actually began his career as an usher at London's Clapham Picture House, and since then he's worked as a cinematographer, producer, writer and director, and this week sees the release of his second feature, Cuckoo, a psychological thriller starring the great Richard E. Grant, Tamsin Gregg and Laura Fraser. The story is of a student-teacher relationship gone very wrong.
This is what I was telling you about. 4 a.m. this finally stopped. It's a man's voice. What's that? Listen. His voice is there.
And I'm thrilled to say that the writer-director of Cuckoo is in the studio with me now. Richard Bracewell, welcome to Film Weekly.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Congratulations on Cuckoo as well, which I have to say is a strange film because I watched it and I felt like I was gradually having a pillow lowered over my head. I was suffocating very slowly with the protagonist, I think. I was there with them, with Laura Fraser. And I thought this was a very strange kind of effect to be having on audience because it was a very atmospheric kind of experience to watch your film.
That's great. I mean, I hope that's a good thing.
In a good way.
It being suffocated in a good way.
I don't know how I get my kicks, but actually I enjoy it.
Exactly. There is a good way. There is a good way and a bad way. I wanted to do a film that was all about the point of view of the central character. I mean, I think that's point of view is just a fascinating thing that doesn't get talked about enough. It's a really fascinating thing in Hitchcock films. Polanski mm-hmm. does it a lot. And having a central character who's suffering from paranoia, who doesn't know whether to believe, whether or not everyone around is telling the truth. I thought it'd be interesting to put the audience with this central character and feed them in and then see if they came out alive, if they came out in one piece.
Yeah, no, well, that sort of really worked. Well, but it took me a while to realise that was what was going on. Is that the idea?
Yeah, very much so. Everything is, or nothing is as it seems, both in terms of what you hear in the film and what you see in the film. I mean, it's lit very chiaroscuro. There's a lot of light and dark. So you think, oh, I get this character. It's clear who they are. It's clear what they represent. But of course, they have a dark side. For every light side of the personality, they have a dark side, and you gradually discover that all the characters have a dark side.
Exactly, and even you've got the lead, Laura Fraser, who always gets cast in sort of ghost related roles. I've noticed recently there was The Boys Are Back, where she played a dead wife, but she came back as a ghost in that thing with David Tennant on the telly.
Yes,
she was also dead. I think she appeared in a picture and she was ghostly, kind of she's dead there. Something about her inspires the supernatural.
It's,
I think
ethereal. Yes, I think the makeup department couldn't wait to get, you know, the pale, make her pale, get the makeup. And of course, if you're having a pale face, you look fantastic. As soon as you put any kind of distinguishing, like red lipstick on, you just have this fantastic.
She's a terrific actress. I always think underused by the British film industry. And we have her on our doorstep and we never see her.
Absolutely. And she took a decision a few years ago, having done these fantastic Hollywood movies, and obviously she'd had a Hollywood experience, had this fantastic CV at a very young age. She took a decision to stay here and work. And I think people are very surprised. I mean, no one more so than me when she walks into the audition. What a fantastic opportunity.
We can't afford you.
That was it. What are you doing here? And, you know, she came here on the basis of the script and the character. So, yes. Underused.
I felt I was looking at that, thinking, well, how'd they get Richard E. Grant as well? I mean, he doesn't do that much, does he, anymore? I mean, he was making his own film last I saw him. You don't get to see him very often in films. How did he come on board?
He came on board partly through the casting director, and I hope partly through the script.
Yeah.
I didn't really know what to say to him because I wasn't really sure why he'd taken it on. I was glad he did, but I don't know what it was in the script that had attracted him, and he came on and he kind of set all my fears at bay. Really, the first day he said, I did it because I wanted to speak the word, the dialogue of the character.
Oh.
And that's interesting because we'd written this character. His character, Jude, he's a professor of cardiology. His subject is the human heart, but his flaw is that he can't form human relationship. Mm-hmm. So it's very straightforward. But he gets all the best lines in the film because he's just so overeducated. He's a polymath who can't actually... He's incredibly repressed and can't express
himself. He's also an amateur expert.
An amateur expert, of course. In the good old way.
Of auditory hallucination. Exactly. Is one of his specialised subjects.
And he jumped at the chance, I think, to do this set piece. And he gets a great set piece in the middle of the film where he sort of talks about what auditory hallucination means, and he goes into, he discusses, I won't tell too much about it.
Yeah, no, don't give it away.
Film, but he has a lovely set piece in the middle, which I was hoping would attract someone of the caliber.
Because they want to do that. Actors, we always think, well, actors are sitting around kind of choosing scripts, but actually most of the time they're not working, are they? And they just can't wait to actually get in front of a camera and do the big number.
Absolutely. Actors want to work. I think there's a great line that Terry Gilliam talks about when he made Time Bandits, which is the first big movie that he'd done after the Python films. And in the script, he talks about there's a battle scene involving King Agamemnon, and he talks in the script, and you see this, it's reproduced the script, Agamemnon removes his helmet to reveal Sean Connery, open brackets, or an actor of lesser stature, close brackets. And they sent it to Sean Connery, and Sean Connery did it. So my script had Professor Julius, played by Richard E. Grant, or an actor of lesser stature, walks the set. And it was Richard E. Grant.
Well, so brilliant. Well, congratulations on that. I think it's good. It's also good to see him because it's not what you'd expect from Richard E. Grant. And that's the sort of theme of the film. Nothing is what it quite seems. And, you know, he gets a kind of noirish walk through kind of the night as well, which you don't expect to see him doing. And he's quite sinister as a figure like that.
Absolutely. And I'm not sure. I can't lay any credit for this, really. I think it was the casting director, Dan Hubbard, who'd seen something sinister in something Richard had done before. Yeah, he's been cast of late in a few roles where he plays, you know, the father or loving uncle, and obviously he's quite well known for Jack and Sarah. It's probably the biggest thing he did after with now. But Dan, it was a Dan the costume director, who'd seen something in him. Of course, I think with Richard, it's all about the voice. I mean, you forget the reason, you know, people don't act with Nell and I out. They quote it. It's all about the dialogue and his beautiful kind of cadences that he does. And of course, as soon as he opened his mouth and he did the character, of course, that was why he did it.
Yeah, no, he's got. I think he's really terrific and already odd in it in the best way. It's called Cuckoo, and I kept thinking, why is it Cuckoo? Is it Cuckoo as in like you're going a bit cuckoo, or is it Cuckoo as in Cuckoo's Nest? Not the Diane Keane comedy, the untouchable and brilliant ITV comedy, but as in laying an egg in someone else's nest.
I really couldn't say.
Okay, it's well, you came up with the name.
It's there. It's up to the
audience. Or is it an homage to Diane Keane and her fine work?
It's there to interpret whichever way you want. The obvious thing is, I guess, that it's cuckoo. You're going curly willy cuckoo. You're going crazy. The central character does doubt her own grip on the world, her own sanity. But there's a cuckoo in the nest, of course, as well.
The release is large-ish. It's doing all right, really, in terms of a release.
I think it's exactly where we should be for a film like this, and it's on over Christmas. It's a bit different to what you're going to get from Tron 3D or you know, Christine Aguilera, and that's the point. So it's there for people to discover.
If you'd sent her the script, she'd have done it.
Well, which character would she have played?
Oh, the sister. Definitely, she'd have been great.
She'd have been the youngest sister.
Yeah, of course she would have been.
Oh, no offence to Antony.
She's brilliant. All your cast are brilliant. As I say, it's a very strange and unsettling film, and that's the kind of way we like it here on Film Willie. So, Richard Bracewell, thank you very much for coming in, and congratulations on Cuckoo.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Cuckoo gets a limited release here in the UK from this Friday, the 17th of December. It's well worth seeking out. And that brings us to a close for Film Weekly this week. Just to mention again, we are looking for your top three films of 2010. I said earlier that myself and Zan Brooks are whittling down our list, but we want to hear yours. Everyone who gets in touch with us through the Facebook site, Film Weekly Fans, will go in the hat and have a chance to win a year's free digital cinema with Curzon On Demand. It's the Curzon's new website. You can watch the latest and best in art house cinema from the comfort of your own couch at the touch of a button. A year's long subscription. It's a brilliant prize to urge you to send in your top threes and join us on Facebook. You know, it worked out well for the Catfish Boys. This fab electronic music you've been listening to throughout the show is, of course, by French electro duo Daft Punk. It's the soundtrack for the new Tron Legacy movie, and it's kicking. Until next week, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.